As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You hungry? I ain't no snitch.
Let's be honest, there's 29 NBA teams and then there's a G League roster with a few stars.
They have a math problem offensively.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History Month.
Chris Mullin, a brother from another mother.
we grew up together, man, in the Bay Area, along with Tim Hardaway. You know, we raised some eyebrows. Run TMC was born. Thank you again for being here with me. Thank you.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History Month.
Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to the Basketball Hall of Fame. Wow. I never ever dreamed of this growing up in Florida. My first love was football. My football hero was Tony Dorsett. I didn't play organized basketball until the 10th grade, but I immediately fell in love with the game. Two of the guys I used to run with were my best friends. One kid was named 4'9". The other kid you might have heard of, Michael Irvin. Basketball soon became my vehicle for self-confidence. Off the basketball court, I was very shy. But on the basketball court, well, that was a different story. I was confident, determined, and I felt I could do no wrong. The ball has meant everything to me. From the first time I ever picked it up, it continues to drive me and guide me to this day. I learned at an early age to respect and honor the game.
And I couldn't be more excited.
The Warriors, man, we were a tight unit. We did everything together. Coach Nelson was one of the most innovative coaches in NBA history, and he put together quite a team.
Sharunas Marcellonas, a fierce competitor,
pushed me every day in practice.
While he was barely 6 feet tall, he was 190 pounds of muscle, determination, strong opinions, always overflowing with confidence. And he certainly didn't act like a rookie. His name, Tim Hardaway.
Tim Bug
was a natural-born leader. And the minute he arrived, he was ordering me and Mully around the court like he owned it.
Always overflowing with confidence.
Run TMC was born, and man, did we have some fun. My mom, Ernell O'Neill. She was my rock growing up. My best friend, my confidant, my everything.
She also wore two hats.
Because of my dad, Mitch Richmond.
Served in the Army, traveling all over the world, including fighting in the Vietnam War.
When my dad was home, he was wonderful. He was a real positive influence in my life. And one thing I took from him, he gave me the dimples. And also my charisma, you know. But I said goodbye to my dad this last June. And I love you, Dad.
I want to thank my two brothers who are here tonight, Michael and Tony.
My grandmother, Emma Thomas, who never missed any of my games. I never held it against her that her favorite player was Larry Bird. Thanks, Larry.
Right in your podcast face.
They have a math problem offensively.
This is Nerder, She Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Moe DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
You see, young. Wait!
This organization.
Mike NBA Show. It's Thursday. We're recording this Thursday, February 3rd. I think it's going to come out on Thursday, but I'm Dave DeFore, and this is Nerder.
The comic is...
She wrote. Seth and Mo are here. What's up, guys?
What's up, Dave?
Big week. Big week. We got a week until the trade deadline. We're very excited. I got some snow in Texas, which... again, completely defeats the purpose of living in Texas. I thought that Texas was supposed to have nice weather year-round, and it's snowy and icy. How's it in Milwaukee?
My children are mad that all the snow has melted.
Yeah, see,
send them to Texas.
This is BS. I need to be in California.
Actually, I went to Texas a couple weeks ago, and my son was mad that I didn't take him with me.
There you go. But Dave, I have actually built the wall. You're not allowed in.
Yeah, they've been trying to keep me out of California for a long time. So we figured a week before the trade deadline and then 2 weeks before All-Star, good time for a good old Nerder mailbag. So we got a ton of questions. And right off the top, I just got to say, it's nice that people that listen to this show get the show. The questions that we got were fantastic, and we're not going to get to all of them because there were a surprising amount of them, but they were very good. We just went and kind of parsed through them over the course of the last 30, 35 minutes, and it was tough to eliminate some of the questions. So thanks, everybody who sent questions on Twitter. We might do another one of these via the Athletic website for subscribers at some point, but for right now, the Twitter mailbag was fantastic. So thanks for all the questions. We're going to jump right in. And the first question from friend of the program, Joey Devine, host of the Round Ball Rock podcast. And I love this question so much. Guys, who is the most average player in the NBA? And Seth, I know you pulled the numbers on this. So before you actually tell us who the statistical most average player is, I want to get into the, you know, who is your idea of the most average player? And Mo, you look like you're chomping at the bit for this one.
I mean, no, I just, you know, Josh Richardson. Like, it's just, like, I mean, it's just like, okay, that's where I saw the question. Ah, Josh Richardson.
Is somebody worse than Kentavious Caldwell Pope, right?
But it's along those lines. That's that area for me. I know Seth's going to dazzle y'all with numbers and things like that.
I don't know. Josh Richardson is pretty good. That's a good pull.
Yeah, no, so, but I will say that there are kind of two ways. There's average in terms of, okay, there's 500 players in the NBA, give or take. Is it the 250th right. best player, or is it the 180th best player? Because we're kind of waiting by who actually is in the game.
See, that's a good point, Seth. And actually, when I read this question, that was my first line of thinking. I think we should say guys who play, right? So, which winds up being a fifth starter, maybe a fourth starter, sixth man, somebody in that sort of range, right? And to me, I mean, I think Josh Richardson's a good one. I think Kyle Kuzma is a good one, although I probably lean toward above average on Kuzma.
I kind of did a quick look at this. First of all, you got to worry about the player size. So it's someone who's between, you know, 6'5 and 6'7. We're talking about guys who actually play. And so I just did a quick look of players 6'5 to 6'7 who are around 15 PER. And, you know, PER is not always the greatest one number, but for something like this, like it is pretty useful. Say like guy, it's about average, does about the right amount of stuff. And a guy who is 6'6 and has a PER of exactly 15, which is league average, is Caleb Martin, which is a very similar answer to Josh Richardson. Other guys kind of in that area are Jeremy Lamb, Will Barton. Like this is the kind of like the rotational wing who is, you know, not a star, but can do some things, but isn't quite a guy. Like, I think that Josh Richardson, Jeremy, like these are all good answers for who is the most average player. So I think Mo came up with a good suggestion, and I think this is a solid group of average that we've developed.
I mean, I think my Kuzma take, I mean, I think he's above average, but someone in that kind of range, that fifth starter is what I was thinking. And Richardson, that kills me. Maybe Dorian Finney-Smith.
Ooh, another good one.
That's a good one.
And if you notice, average players can actually take their value north By shooting more threes.
Yeah.
That's just the easiest way to contribute a little bit more for an average player. All right, next question.
Where does RJ Barrett rank in this, Seth? Sorry, I had to make the joke.
Above Cam Reddish.
Bing bong. Yeah, he got you. Well, I mean, we don't know about Cam Reddish because we haven't seen him play in so long. I don't know if he can play.
Do we not know? I think we know.
Next question from friend of the show, John Lichtenstein, SBC student. Can you guys share specifics on how ownership affects a team? I think most understand that it's important, of course, but how exactly can good or bad ownership impact a group's chances at winning? Who wants to jump on that one first?
So there's a line to tread here. In my mind, this question almost like it leads to like, you know, the Suge Knight. Do you want the producer all up in the video dancing and rapping on the like? There is not an owner in the NBA who spends enough time to be competent to make basketball decisions, to actually make the decisions. Now, big enough decisions, you need to convince the owner this is a good idea, and that's as it should be because that's who's signing the checks. But you want them to get out of the way, basically. But you don't want them to be so out of the way that they're just oblivious to whoever is making the decisions, having bad process and not hiring the right people under them. So there's a balance there. And it's basically like someone who A, knows what they don't know, but B, can identify the people who can both make those decisions and set up processes that allow them to make good decisions. So that's sort of nonspecific other than I think you can surmise. I'm talking about a few owners in particular when I'm talking about making basketball decisions, and that never ends well. But yeah, so that's in broad terms. I think that's how they can have the most impact. And then obviously being willing to spend money is, you know,
yeah, right.
It's kind of a big deal.
Mo, you have a unique experience in that you worked for one of the worst ownership, you know, guys, I guess, ever. How was that?
I mean, I'll be honest, like he didn't interfere all that much. He was just absolutely racist and misogynistic, which, you know, kind of a problem. For the most part, you know, the it was interesting with Sterling was in the early years he never wanted to spend. Once, you know, that they made that run in literally just before I got there, I think it was like 2005. They pushed the Suns to a 7-game series and things like that. He got a little bit of a taste and slowly started putting money into the organization. And then he wanted to try to win and did spend. But the problem is, again, he's racist and misogynistic and should have never had a team in the first place with all that stuff. But I want to go to something that's more important here, which is it's something Seth touched on. Hire the right people and let the people do their jobs. You know, the meddling owner sometimes is the issue. And the thing Seth says when he says, hey, like, they're never going to be able to have enough time to be competent in terms of NBA level, because obviously they became billionaires in another industry, right? Like, you know, as much as, you know, Steve Ballmer thinks he might know everything about the NBA, he doesn't. And that's probably unfair because he doesn't act that way. But, you know, it's just kind of that thought of like, it's thinking a front office guy is going to be able to make Microsoft what Steve Ballmer was, right? Like by learning it being around for 5 years. So I think that's an important aspect of it. But getting out of the way, you know, in the sense of like, let the guys you hire do their jobs. I mean, that's kind of the way I viewed it with the Spurs with Peter Holt for all those years. You know, he did a great job of RC and Pop. They're running the show when there's a big decision that needs to be made. Obviously, your final decision goes to the owner, but like, trust your guys. Everything Seth said, put a process in place, things like that. They get comfortable with it and they go with it. But it's the guys like, you know, Ron Adive, who's like, we got to do this right now, or this is who I want, or, you know, this guy's going to be the next Steph Curry or whatever. Like, all that stuff, that's a problem for ownership. That's a problem for a team. And you can only go so far when you have an owner like that.
Let me follow this up. Okay, are there any teams with meddling owners where it works out? And if so, could you point to the meddling owner as being the reason it worked out? Or is it, you know, I don't know, they stumbled on a generational superstar?
I'm going to reach back in the bag because this is, I'm going to go way back.
Yeah.
I would say Jerry Buss was, Dr. Buss was probably a great owner for the Lakers, had a vision for the Lakers, you know, but this is back in the 80s. Like, you know, like I can't wait for this show coming out. With all that stuff. But, like, you know, he had kind of a vision of how he wanted things to be in L.A. and things like that. And he meddled in everything, getting stars to the game and things like that and the product he wanted to see on the court. But at the same time, he let the basketball guys make basketball decisions, you know, from my understanding. He was involved in it and things like that, but he wasn't to the point where it was overbearing. So I would say that would probably be the shining example. That's, you know, the problem for the Lakers is there's nobody that can continue that on. I don't think Jeannie Buss has that in her. We obviously know Jim Buss sure as hell doesn't. And I think that's the problem with it. It's hard to find.
And I think that that's also, it was a very different time in terms of the level of competition. And I don't mean on the floor. I mean, kind of as front offices grown, front offices have grown, and the sophistication of the decisions and kind of the use of the salary cap and all these things has improved. Like the comparative advantage of, you know, having the nicest plane and practice facility, that those things like do matter around the edges, but they don't matter relatively as much as kind of the detailed work and process of making good basketball decisions. And, you know, in the 80s, like, when a lot of that stuff wasn't happening, when, you know, the front offices were very small and decisions were across the board worse, the advantage you gained by just having like the fancy stuff was substantial.
Also, that era was just different, right? And now, like, everything is corporatized. NBA teams are corporations now. And back then, it was a mom and pop. So it was a little bit different.
Now you have multiple owners, right? Like ownership groups and things like that. And you know, you look at the Warriors and they have, you know, it's Joe Laka, but there's also a bunch of other people have small pieces and are involved in a way of like their money. They don't have much of a basketball say, but there's a lot of that stuff, you know, and I think that's also something. It is very different, but I think we're also what we're going to deem as a good owner is going to change over the next few years, because I don't think we're going to have a lot of teams that are going to be just a single person is they own the team. I think that's going to be the change we'll see over the years.
Sure. No, I was going to say that, you know, there are these multiple ownership groups. And in some cases, there are like the silent partners, and in some cases, it's the very noisy partners that lead to some decision. Like I think we've seen in Atlanta, particularly, there was like fallout of there being kind of an ownership battle between people that led to some disruption on the basketball side, and so that's the kind of the competing factions is something that can happen in a sort of a, and you know, frankly, the Lakers too have a little of this, and it's a succession style inner family dispute, but it's still kind of, there are multiple competing visions, and that is always difficult, because then you kind of get dragged this way and that.
All right, guys, next question. This one pretty specific, from Sean W. What will the Mavs do about Jalen Brunson? Will they attach to another contract to see if they can improve on the wing or at center? Do they offer him $17 to $20 million per year this summer? They see what he gets in free agency and match the deal. Jalen Brunson, I mean, look, guy's been good, very clearly an NBA starter. My reservations with Jalen Brunson are all about small guards generally and how they progress in age. Not everybody's Fred VanVleet, you know, where they can have a nice couple seasons and then continue to get better. Usually the size limitations for small guards are my primary concern. But Brunson's good, and he's going to get paid by somebody, if not the Mavs. So they're going to have a choice to make. Would you guys try to move him now, or do you think the Mavs should keep him? I just – the fit is – it's okay. Like, it works. He's good. I just don't know about the longer-term fit.
I mean, if I'm the Mavs, if it comes down to this, you know, and we know how teams are, like, I'm sure there were discussions of what would you guys be looking for with his agent, you know, along those lines of like, what do you, if it's a number where it's like, yo, that's astronomical, then you got to move him. Right. But if it's something where they feel like, nope, that makes sense, that's kind of what we're thinking, I think you hold on to him. You know, I think he's an important piece, even if it's not somebody that you think long term's a great fit. He's going to have trade value. And that's an important aspect going forward for a team with not a lot of trade prospects and assets that you feel like you really like. So I think it's actually going to be really important that they re-sign him, but at a number that makes sense. I think that's actually what's going to happen. I kind of look at I think of him kind of like a $15 to $18 million a year type guy. You know, I know it sounds crazy. I mean, we're talking funny money here, but like I think that's kind
average
of
starter money.
Yeah. You know, I think that's what he deserves. And, you know, if a team comes in here and wants to pay him $25 million, good luck. You can't tie yourself up like that.
So he's an interesting kind of study in how the dynamics of succeeding with a late draft pick is weird. initially he kind of gets the guy like that tends to get overvalued. For two reasons. One, okay, well, this is, you know, a fantastic contract. We can't possibly trade this. And two, he is a reflection of how smart we are as an organization. And you kind of want to have that around. So we found this guy that is a starter level player in the second round. And look at this, blah, blah, blah. And so that makes you kind of hold on a little too tightly. And just from a mechanical standpoint, the fact that he makes basically minimum money makes it hard to trade him and get, you know, on-court value back. The flip side is then he's going from being like valuable in part because he's so like dollar efficient for how good he is on the floor to being essentially neutrally, perhaps even slightly negatively dollar efficient as he gets paid kind of commensurately with that. So while yes, he will be like, assuming he doesn't drop off dramatically, he will be tradable on a, you know, a 4-year $80 million contract, give or take. But you're kind of – it's sort of like for like. It's like that's a neutral value contract. What are we getting as the value in that? He's a guy who's in a deal. He's not the guy who is the deal on that situation.
And a side note there is that they also have a Dorian Finney-Smith decision to make, and I don't think that they can keep both guys. I mean they would be well into the tax if that's the case. I mean, do you want to pay a big tax bill for this team? I wouldn't. I think they've got some Porzingis decisions to make. I mean, I don't know what his value is like.
They don't have a Porzingis decision to make, because I don't think there's anywhere to, like, who's chomping at the bit to trade for Porzingis. There's not a decision to be made. They're stuck.
But, I mean, you're right. He's already in Dallas. Are you going to send him to Indiana?
But I would say this, and this is the problem. Like, if they're not willing to go into the tax, because I think you got to re-sign both guys. I get it, and then figure out the rest later. But you can't do a pick and choose situation and let one walk. I think you got to go into the tax here. You have Luka. You need to start building something here. And even if it's we're going to sign and not we're not going to have them at the end of one of them's going to get moved.
Or a sign and
whatever
trade.
Whatever it is, you know. But I think you have to look and you can't be afraid. You have a guy like Luka, and we see this with teams. You can't be afraid to run into the tax, you know. And yes, it sucks. This team may not be a contender right now in the way they're positioned. They're playing pretty well. Like, I'm shocked they're still pretty good on defense. I don't know what the hell's going on in Dallas, but you know they're still. I've watched a lot of Dallas games. I still can't figure it out, but it's still there. I think you got to just kind of go with it and stay in. You have to be willing to go into the tax and then start figuring it out. Maybe you do got to find a way to attach an asset to get off Porzingis with, you know, that contract to free up stuff. But I don't think it's a situation. You have guys that are good. Those guys make sense for this team. You can't just let them walk.
Would you package Brunson with Porzingis to move Porzingis? Like, if a team was interested in Brunson – Porzingis is look, when he's healthy, he's been pretty good. I don't know. Is that too much to give up if you're Dallas?
So I would only – I'm going to push
– It's a big step back.
I'm going to push back on what Mo said just a little bit is I think Luka kind of cuts both ways because, okay, we have a good enough top guy to be a championship guy. right now, do you have concerns that Jalen Brunson can be a playoff performer? I think you have to. He's been he was unplayable in the first round last year. And if you're, you know, you want to be at the level commensurate with Luka's talent, your thought process for any big move and expenditure you're making is, what does this look like in the second round of the playoffs or later? And how confident are you that paying Jalen Brunson starter money does not mean that we have a $20 million hole in our roster in the second round of the playoffs? So that's why I would be far more aggressive about shaking things up than standing pat, because I think you're doing that thing where you're moving closer to, even though you have Luka, locking yourself into pretty good.
I think the way I would look at it with Brunson, though, is I think he got better than he was last season. I'm with you. We still have to have questions of where he would fit in the playoffs and things like that. I think he's a different player than last season. I think he learned a little more. I think that goes a long way with that. And again, it's just, I'm not saying you're keeping him forever, but, you know, at a certain point, like, hey, maybe it is a sign and trade. Maybe it is a situation where you're looking to move him after, you know, halfway through that deal or even 6 months into it. But I think it's just, you don't have a lot of assets on that team, and he's a guy that's going to have some stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, and especially you lose Tim Hardaway Jr. You're already shorthanded on the wing anyway. I'm with you there on being aggressive. Next question. Okay. First off, from left to right, Hezzy, do y'all have Letterboxd accounts I can follow? And Letterboxd is, I guess this is the movie review social media website. Who has time to watch movies? Seth, like, when was the last time you watched a movie?
Like a movie I hadn't seen before?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think, like, my wife and I went and saw House of Gucci a couple weeks ago, which was very good. But yeah, no, I don't.
Yeah.
I think all three of us are much more in like the shows, because they're like bite sized.
I love movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love movies too, but I now am watching movies like 30 to 45 minutes at a time. And I don't even have kids to make the excuse. My thing is just like, I think most movies now are bad and they're all just derivative. And it's like, oh, I've seen this movie before. It was called Star Wars.
No, so for me, it's one, I love going to the movie theater. I love going to the movies. Okay. And then on top of that, I have the AMC pass, which is $20, a month. And I get three or four free movies like a month. So really, if I just go see a movie, I'm pretty much covering up the cost of going to that. Yeah. And then I get a whole bunch of like money off for food and snacks and things like that. Like, it's actually a winner. It's just sucks during COVID. I haven't gone as much.
Discover the latest collections from David Yurman, as seen recently, styled on basketball stars like Jaime Jaquez, Jalen Green, D'Angelo Russell, and others. David Yurman is a celebrated American jewelry company inspired by the beauty of art, architecture, and the natural world. The story of David Yurman begins in New York City with David, a sculptor, and his wife, Sybil, a painter and ceramicist. When the artists began collaborating, their goal was to simply make beautiful, designed objects to wear. Over 40 years later, the Yurmans and their son, Evan, continue to redefine American luxury jewelry with timeless, modern collections for women and men defined by inspiration, innovation, consummate craftsmanship, and cable, the brand's artistic signature. David Yurman's collections are available on davidyurman.com.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The second part of this question from left to right, Hezzy. I know the Grizzlies are the shiny new plaything, but what are some problems y'all see with them come playoff time? For me, it's that all of our three-point shooters are either on or off, and the off nights are annoyingly frequent. And that matches the eye test. Feels like the Grizzlies do miss a ton of open shots. It's kind of like Dallas.
No, actually, I'm glad you tied those two together, because this, that sort of same Jalen Brunson combo kind of applies to Memphis a little bit. And they have solved the problem of, aside from kind of the developmental minutes that Zaire Williams is getting, like, they put no bad players on the floor.
Right. By the way, Zaire Williams had a really great game last night.
Yeah. I mean, they played against the Knicks, so, you know, good matchup, favorable matchup. But aside from, you know, obviously Ja is someone who you can feel reasonably confident is going to be, you know, a superb level performer later in the playoffs. The point where you flip from no bad players to all your minutes by really good players, like, a lot of their guys would need to be just a little bit better, like, mm-hmm. to be that second round playoff, second round plus. You know, I hate to go back to this all the time, but it's because I think the formulation is too simplistic, but it's, you know, the 82 game versus 16 game player. And
it works. Yeah,
and
it works. Simple works.
And yeah. Like, okay, you think about the guys who are important on their team, like, you know, relative to the level of competition when there's eight teams left, where is Dylan Brooks? Where is Steven Adams? Where is Jaren Jackson at this point, to be honest? Like, these guys are, like, good players, but you're, aside from Ja, it seems like you're giving up in the matchups, you're giving up a lot at slots like two through whatever, relative to that level of competition. Whereas in the regular season, the fact that you can go through 12 with good NBA players matters more.
Yeah, I think they're more right now an 82-game season team than anything else. And it's not a shot at them. They're also incredibly young. For everything Seth outlined, I still think there's a level of talent that they need to kind of raise up in certain areas. Jaren Jackson kind of disappears in games from time to time, and that's a little bit problematic for me. When I look at in the playoffs, you need him never to disappear, right? You need him to be the the second guy, you know, and it's they win a lot of games with somebody random going off, which is helpful, right? A game where John Conchar has a monster, you know, final 5 minutes in a game, or Tyus Jones and things like that. And these are all good players, but it's like you need more of the consistency from the other guys, because come playoff time, it gets harder. And they know it because they went through it last year. But it just gets so much harder in the playoffs when teams are going to be able to drill down. Teams are going to go under screens on Ja more often, in that, you know, let him go for the dribble pull up, you know, threes. And you know, he doesn't have that pull up mid range yet. And I think that's where teams are going to kind of drill down on how they're going to defend him and really lock into him. So I think there's some of those issues coming along, and consistency from everybody else is going to matter.
Is there a potential first round opponent that you guys would be super worried about the Grizzlies running into? So for me, the first team I think of is the Lakers, right? Like, a 3-6 matchup, the Grizzlies certainly aren't scared of the Lakers, but I just think that the experience difference, and when you have LeBron out there, like, that would worry me if I was the Grizzlies. Is there somebody maybe besides the Lakers that you guys think could give them a hard time?
Damn you, Seth, for beating me to this. Damn you, but I'm going to talk before you. I just think Jokic's ability, like, Jokic can win you a playoff series on his own. And I think that's one where he would just have these guys kind of like, what, you know, like, all of just the way he can manipulate defenses and things like that, like, he would have them sort of running around in a way. I think it makes it really challenging for them. So I think Denver would be the team I'm more afraid of. I actually think,
especially if Jamal Murray's back.
Yeah, which I don't think he will be. If I'm Denver, I'm not playing him this season. Sorry. Like, I know Jokic is having this whole year and everything. I'm not risking Murray. Let's go for a championship next year. I will say this. If they play the Lakers, I think I'm picking Memphis. I don't think the Lakers have any ability to guard guards. And I think Ja Morant is going to have a monster series on them. And as we've seen, they are not afraid of this team. They love talking trash and all of that stuff, and to the point that it irritates LeBron. But I think it's, hey, we're coming for your neck. And I think they would enjoy and relish a chance at the Lakers more than they would Denver.
I'm trying to imagine how many bad pull-ups Dylan Brooks would bait Westbrook into.
Oh, my gosh.
All of them. All of them.
I don't want to take us off the rails here. Is Westbrook going to be playing in the playoffs for the Lakers? You think
they're
so?
They're not.
Depends on how they do in the play-in game.
Make it to the playoffs.
That's a good one.
So, look, here's a little side question about Westbrook that I thought was just funny. Well, actually, Seth, you sent it to me from Tribe on Twitter. What kind of contract offer and role, hypothetically, do you think Russell Westbrook would get from a decent playoff team on the open market if he was a free agent this offseason? He goes on to say he couldn't see him getting any more than 10 to 15 million pounds and a bench role. I did the conversion there. That's $13 to $20 million. That's as of today, February 3rd, for all my Forex folks. So I don't know. Would he get 15 million pounds on the open market? I don't think so.
I didn't know the British basketball. He had it like that. But
yeah, look, the Russ stuff is rough, man. I've enjoyed watching Russ for so long, and this is just—it's bad. It's all the worst stuff turned up to 11. Okay, here's our next question. This is from Derek Podchin, another friend of the show. Why are NBA coaches so against substitutions in overtime? I believe the 3-OT game only had 3 total subs, all by Miami, who was doing offense-defense swaps with like 10 seconds left. So, guys, why aren't coaches substituting more at end of games and in overtime?
I think part of it, especially in that game for Toronto, was look at the other guys on the bench. You know, they weren't in a situation where they were going to play those guys. I think Chris Boucher was the biggest name on that bench after that. And it just wasn't, he hasn't had the year and the impact like he had last season. So I think that's part of the issue for Toronto. I think part of it is you're not thinking in the first overtime, this is going to a second overtime. You're not in the right. second overtime thinking this is going to a third overtime. And you're very thankful at the end of the third overtime that it's not going to a fourth overtime, whether you won or lost. It's an important note. You know, the Heat went for a 3, down 2, because they were just like, yup, we're we're either making this or we're going home type of deal. So I think that's part of the calculation when you say, why don't coaches make substitutions? It's not like they're thinking in the first quarter, hey, I need this guy in the fourth quarter. They're trying to win these next 5 minutes.
And also, time telescopes kind of, we know that, at the end of a game, the last 3 minutes of a game takes 20 minutes in real time, and that continues through the overtime period. So there's a lot more kind of stops. And so it's not the same, generally speaking, especially because, late game, we kind of start to get the prevent stand around offense anyway. So I think that those minutes, while they might be more intense, are probably not on balance as athletically taxing as, in terms of taking players' wind, as some other points in the game might be. So it's you don't gas players out quite the same way in an overtime session as you would we're playing him the last 8 minutes of the fourth quarter.
Well, it has gotten worse though, because we don't have all the replay reviews. Worse for players. I don't, better for me. Please get me out of there. Respect my time. I want to do other
2 stuff.
2-point
game. Must go for 3. I think everyone would prefer to see you take a 3 there. Just get us in, get us out.
Yes. Good argument.
Yes, it is,
Seth.
Yes, it is.
I don't know. Mo?
I don't know what you guys are talking about.
If we just did the Elam ending,
stop it. These guys wouldn't have to play all these minutes. We're not doing this show.
Next question from Zombies Can Dunk. In light of the Brian Flores lawsuit in the NFL, have you ever been told directly or had it strongly implied that you were to help facilitate a tank? When you work for a team, this obviously is a question for you guys, since you work for teams. Who wants to take that one first?
So I think Mo probably has the closer perspective, because even when we were just okay, my first couple of years with the Bucks, we were too good to tank. We finished right around 5.
We had Giannis.
Yeah, exactly. We had like my first year was his first All-Star year, and we were just if you're about a 500 team, you got to work really hard.
Did you hear that, Dave? He took credit for Giannis's All-Star. Go ahead.
Yes. Clearly, that's what I did. Well,
handed him a spreadsheet, and next thing you know.
He wants to look at a chart while we're playing, talking hoops.
That's right.
We were too good to tank, but also, and this correlates to sort of the years, like the first Bud year when we were better, is there were situations where you maybe wanted to be strategic and like, you know, okay, if we can we work in a certain way that our first round playoff matchup is more favorable or something like that. And, you know, basically every time I looked at it, it was like, it's just let's just play basketball. It's not, you know, just from a metric standpoint, I think there's one year where it was the year where the Cavs were like bad in the regular season. And so it's like, well, by every metric, we should want to play Cleveland, but it's like
the worst defense also, in the league, or 29th defense.
But at the same time, yeah. It's like, okay, yeah, that we, but LeBron, it was still very much in the height of but LeBron. It's like, oh, like let's just do whatever and play. And then again, the year we were, I remember coming down the stretch of my last year, the year we lost to the Raptors in the conference finals. Like I think based on who we played late in the season, we could have had some say in who we were going to play in the first round. And it was just like, hey, if we're going to rest guys to rest guys, we'll do that, but let's not try to mess around with other things because it doesn't matter. We're going to be massively better than whoever we play anyway. And so it's just, you know, play how we're going to play. And maybe if we're looking at, again, if we're looking at rest and injury prevention, that should be the only reason we're making these decisions, not trying to be strategic about who we want to play.
Well, one, before I get to the tanking part of the question, don't mess with the basketball gods. That's really one of those things for me. Just don't go play. You know, it reminds me of the year Denver really kind of tried to tweak things so that they and it worked. Golden State and Houston had to play in the second round of the playoffs. It was Denver and Portland in the second round of the playoffs, and they were engineering it so that they didn't have to play both of those teams. They were going to play one of those teams if they got to the conference finals, but they did not get to the conference finals. The Portland Trailblazers did. So it just along those lines. And they almost didn't get out of the first round because they went 7 with San Antonio. So there's that. Seth's waving his finger. So let's
go. This reminds me of something I just really want to see. Like, you know, playoff seeding is whatever. I want to see a draft. I want to see the one seed says we want to play them. The two seed says the level of like petty that would
have been. That's different. That's
like,
fun.
I like, you know, this is a way of getting out of angering the basketball gods. This is just like, no, we're forced to pick one. So we think you suck.
I mean, we're just throwing out play you. Dream scenarios, yeah. Guys. Look, the single elimination every team NBA tournament would
Dave,
rule.
That's not a dream scenario for video guys. Just want you to know that. Okay. just understand that one for all the prep we got to do. But to go back to the tanking stuff. First off, let's just start with when I was with those really bad Clipper teams, we didn't have to try to tank. We sucked. We were bad. We tanked. We were really bad. The one year where we just missed out on the playoffs was a frustrating year, and it was interesting because we had no intentions of tanking. We wanted to make the playoffs. We just missed the cut. I think we finished 9th, ended up having the 14th pick in the draft with all that stuff. But, like, you know, it's – I've not experienced that. I know there's definitely teams that are going into seasons going, hey, like, we're not going to be good. We're just going to develop our young guys. And that's kind of the code word, right? Like, that's we're going to try to tank here a little bit.
Tank-veloping.
Yeah. There you go. But, you know, I think
I don't mind that.
I don't mind it if they're actually developing their young guys.
Right.
And that's the important thing. You know, I've gotten in trouble before, so I'm not going to go off on a rant there. But, like, you know, when it's you're sitting guys, young guys, for long stretches to make sure you're not putting yourselves to win, or you're playing guys out of position to make sure you lose a game, that's not developing, and that's not helping that guy, and that's not helping your team in the future and things like that. So for me, ultimately, my dream scenario is the NBA just says screw it and wipes away the odds and goes 1 through 14 on the draft lottery. You want to get rid of tanking, because I hate tanking. Let's not make it a reward. Even they did a good job flattening the odds for the top three teams. We still have teams trying to tank. Mm-hmm. 1 through 14, good luck.
Yeah, I mean, like, players don't tank.
No.
Number one. And so, to me, it gets into a disrespectful space, like, of the player. If the organization goes out of their way, all right, well, we're going to be worse. This is where I respect a team like Memphis. Memphis is ahead of the schedule, right? They didn't purposely tank. Their guys got better, and they were a team where I bet if you asked them privately, would you rather lose than win? I bet last year they probably, if you really forced them, they'd say, oh yeah, we probably would rather lose for a year or two because you get more assets. It's just, again, like Mo just pointed out, it's the name of the game, but they were happy to win. And I think that you got to just be in the world that we exist in the NBA where you have the lottery. That's the best of that situation.
So I think there's a little bit of revisionism going on here is if you remember,
maybe
if you remember the year before they drafted Ja, they were very judicious with Mike Conley's health, shall we say. They had some bad lineups on the floor that 18-19 season. So
was that the year that – did he have the knee or yeah, was it
I think
groin?
He had the Achilles soreness if I want to say. But they
– Okay, that's what it was.
They,
yeah.
I mean, I think that – was that the year they lost by like 60-some to the Warriors earlier in the year? Anyway, that was
– Yeah, you're right. Maybe I am kind of sugarcoating this a little bit.
Now what
I'm thinking mostly the last couple years.
What they didn't do was have like multiple years of whatever, but that's also – well, this Morant kid's pretty good. Like
right.
That's,
yeah.
that, that's
right.
Sort of,
right. Yeah.
That has a way of shifting your thinking a little bit. So it's you know, it while we are like I think they have done a good job building up with that, mm-hmm. You do have to acknowledge that it wasn't like completely up to them and they got, you know, compared to some other teams that have maybe stayed kind of in the low spot for a number of years, like Orlando has never drafted anybody and they've been bad, like close to the level Ja is. Like as good as right. much as we like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Ja's a much better player.
Yeah, question. There's no question about that. And I'm not and wasn't equating the two in terms of players and things like that. It's in those things. The other thing that Memphis their batting average on draft picks is amazing, right?
They draft good players.
Which is really, you know, like they have what they're going for and they nail it almost every time. And that's something that's kind of spectacular in a way that like no real team can do. And I don't know if anybody could duplicate even Memphis going in the future. Like it's almost like they're due for like, okay, we're going to really whiff on a guy here at some point. But it's, you know, they've done a great job building around Ja and all those things. And you have to get lucky. You just have to get lucky. If they get the first pick in that draft, they probably get Zion, and then it's a whole different scenario.
Yeah, no, I did. It's funny. Yeah. I did a pod with Sam Vecenie about a month ago where we did a redraft of that, and we kind of talked. Even knowing what we know now, it's still like I still kind of feel like you pick Zion because I think he like, but Ja's been like obviously Zion's had his problem, and Ja is on that like. Breaking into the top 10 players in the league kind of discussion level that you at least have to think about it. The other thing we need to say about Memphis is they seem to have hired a very good coach who can both like win now and help develop players.
Fantastic coach.
It's such an amazing line. It's such an amazing line to thread. That thing's one of the hardest things that so many teams have failed at.
And let's not forget getting Desmond Bane where they got him. What the hell? That's just fair.
But on top of that, though, that like you do something smart like, oh, man, they gave Grayson Allen away. Well, that's sort of, you know, it's you can't play Peña at first base because we want this guy to play. Like Grayson Allen, good basketball player, but will be better long term if we let Desmond Bane grow. And like that seems to have.
His arms are too short to play first base, exactly. though. Let's just get that clear.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day, or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, guys. Last question from Nelson Hayes. Actually, got kind of a two-parter here. So, first part from Nelson Hayes. Second part from Steven Anderson. First part: if defensive stats are noisy at best, and stats in general aren't any good in the playoffs because of small sample size, and the playoffs are all that really matter to a lot of players, then what good are defensive stats at all? Now, that's the first part of the question. Now, the second part of the question. 538 ranks Jokic as the second best defensive player in the NBA. Not he has just improved his defense good, but he should be defensive player of the year good. What is more likely? They are right or their use of adjusted plus minus data is flawed? If it is the latter, what is the flaw? So I thought that these two questions kind of went well together because it does. I mean, we've talked a lot already about 16 game players versus 82 game players. Defensive stats are noisy. We talk about that quite a bit. But also, Jokic is pretty damn good too. So, like, you can get information, right?
Sure. The thing we have to realize is even those that stat always has to be interpreted. It's never this is something that I anytime I'm you know teaching or whether it's someone who's working for me or someone who's asking advice on this stuff, the numbers don't say, you say. So literally the only thing – and there's a good blog post about this, which I'll try to dig up and link for folks. I forget who wrote it. That literally the only thing objective about the stat that says Jokic is second best in defensive Raptor is that Jokic is second highest in defensive Raptor. Like that's the anything past that, like sort of tautological thing, is interpretation that you're putting on this. Why does this matter? And then that gets into the question of, well, what's the stat missing? How is the methodology affecting it? Is this more of a directional indicator than it is an exact ranking? The answer there, strongly yes, especially on sort of a partial season sample. So yeah, on that, like just saying, well, he's second in defensive Raptor, therefore, like you're skipping. You're skipping the important part of the discussion there, like, and that means because, like, why do you think that indicates that he's been? How does it change the fact that, like, affect you know what that says about his teammates as much as it says about him or the context that other players are playing in? So it's not enough information basically to just say this, therefore a conclusion. That's a very poor use of advanced stats to try to argue that way.
Mo, my thing here with defensive stats is that so much of the statistics that we have are about actual like actions that happen, not process. And defense is impossible to judge without actually watching the process. So I have to go eye test. Personally, the stats just don't tell me enough. They can tell me, oh, this guy blocks a lot of shots, but I need to see the defense to know why. You were
thinking
on
no,
that?
No, my problem with defensive stats is it can't tell you when somebody forces somebody to not take a shot, right? Like, and or this forces somebody into a bad shot and they just happen to make the shot, right? Like, there are times where I'll watch a clip going, like, that's absolutely amazing defense. And Devin Booker can just shoot the hell out of the ball, right? Like there's right, just, yeah. It's just some of that is difficult. And I know we have the luck adjustment and all these things with the advanced metrics and stuff like that. It's just defense is very hard to quantify in the NBA in the sense of the non-recorded action or the event is sometimes what makes it a good defense. The way I always kind of talk about it is when somebody's fronting a big man, right? Say you have Chris Paul fronting Jokic and they're trying to get the ball to Jokic over the top, but they can't because Mikal Bridges is helping on the backside, right? And okay, fine. They swing and they get a contested three out of it. The Suns are going to get dinged for a bad defensive possession on that. But really, where the Nuggets wanted to go, they took that away. You know, and then now the Nuggets just had to hit a bailout three from Aaron Gordon, which you would give up. You know, it's like that was the result. That was the process they were willing to go with. The result just didn't work out. So it's hard in that sense with defensive stats to figure all of that out.
I think that I don't want to go too far with saying we can't know anything. We have some reasonable indicators that when this player helps a defense in how he's being used right now, he helps a team be more effective defensively. Like we have some pretty okay directional indicators like that.
It says even stuff like deflections, right? Like tracking deflections. I mean, for me,
I mean, at the NBA level, deflections actually tracks very closely with steals. Like there are not mm-hmm. a lot of players who get a lot of deflections and don't get a lot of steals. So it's like it's an interesting thing to see, but you can kind of pick up on the same thing with another kind of more readily available stat. But the more important part is it doesn't tell you why. And when we're getting into sort of playoff situations, like, you know, this has been a Jazz thing for a number of years, is with kind of their lack of perimeter athleticism, but guys who are smart positional defenders in a regular season setting, these are guys who are able to be effective defensively because they're playing intelligently and have Gobert behind them. Yet in the playoffs where you can kind of say, okay, if we put like Bogdanović in this kind of action, we will get an advantage and go to the rim. And if we can do that over and over and over again, all of a sudden, because you're targeting that specific thing that he's bad at, that doesn't show up in this aggregate stat, he suddenly in that environment is not an effective defender and is not an effective defender in a way that kind of torpedoes the whole defense and makes people say stupid things like Rudy Gobert got played off the floor.
Well, I guess let's circle back to the second part of the question. Is Nikola Jokic on either of your defensive player of the year ballots at this point? Like, is he in your top, let's say top 10? I mean, like, let's really expand the field.
I mean, he's probably in my top 10, but not in the top three or four, maybe. I think it's, first off, let's preface it with this. Draymond Green and Rudy Gobert have been out. Right. And have missed a lot of time. So they're not going to win.
And they're 1-2 in perpetuity until they're not. Right.
Right. You know, and Giannis is right there with them in that 1-2-3, like however you want to organize that. I think that's where they're at. He's a lot closer to being a defensive player of the year than he was in years past. Like what he's done is phenomenal. I actually wrote about his defense a few weeks back for an article for Bleacher Report. I think, you know, he's been very impressive on that end. I'm not there yet to call him the defensive player of the year or put him in like my top five.
No, I think that's right. I think he is. I think the improved conditioning has certainly helped with this. I think he's tended to have been on an overall standpoint. I think he's actually been slightly underrated defensively for most of his career because he's smart. He's obviously a great rebounder. He's got good nose for the ball.
Great hands.
Just being kind of big and in the way at the rim is better than nothing.
But they also use him differently, right? Like, so they tend to flash him to the ball and send him to trap and get him to use his hands quite a bit.
His small space agility, even if he's mm-hmm. not. But his greater mobility has helped. But that's still saying he's a good above average defender. I still think that there's a gap between that and, you know, your Giannis's, Gobert's, Embiid's, your elite perimeter defenders like Mikal Bridges, Jrue Holiday. So I think that
Matisse Thybulle, I can't believe you forgot his name. What are you doing?
Matisse Thybulle. Yeah.
But guys that can erase mistakes that other guys make, that's that top.
That's what I was about level. To say, Dave. It's that being up and guarding a guy and seeing somebody break out and getting down to the rim and getting there and being able to get rid of that, whether it's a block shot, whether it's being in position, whatever it is, Jokic isn't there yet. And that is the ultimate separator, I think, when we go defensive player of the year type stuff. This doesn't mean we think he's a bad defender. Don't anybody start coming at us with all of this.
We just sat here and said he's a great defender. You know,
and all of that stuff is just like
hammered this home.
You are literally saying top five out of like 450 NBA players. Like, there's just a level of that. And I want to go on one more small rant.
Oh.
Steals and blocks are not necessarily an indicator of you're a good defender, right? Like, let's just be honest. Hassan Whiteside for a while was in the, if not didn't lead the league in blocks, was in the top three. None of us would count on him for a defensive stop if the game was on the line. Like, none of us would feel comfortable with that. You know, it's along those lines. Same thing with steals. It's easy to cherry pick steals and stuff like that. They can help, but it's not the end all be all. So, like, if you come to me saying this dude leads the league in blocks, how is he not a good defender? I go like, well, let me show you why. And things like that. And same with steals. Like, Russ gambles a crap ton for steals. He's not a good defender. We all can agree on that, right? And even his gambles are risky as hell, even when he comes up with them. So I think it's just an important thing I wanted to note there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I should also point out something important. Ben Simmons' opponents shooting 0% against him this season.
Okay.
So,
no. Okay.
That's a good note.
Okay.
My least favorite stat is the this guy gives up this percentage of shots and whatever. It's like, no, I'm sorry, man. That doesn't work for me. That is not even a noisy stat. That is a bad stat.
Yes, exactly. This is one of those things. Well, more information is always, but no, this is not information. This is randomness. Yeah. This is, I flipped a coin 20 times and here's what happened. Therefore, look how good a coin flipper I am. I don't want to make that a blanket statement because, again, I'm sure we've talked about this 18 times on this show. But, like, defending shots at the rim is a sort of special case where that's a repeatable skill fairly obviously. You come around Rudy Gobert, you come around Joel Embiid, you come around Miles Turner at the rim, you're going to miss more often. Like, no shit. But if we're talking about, like, oh, the jump shots that he happened to be closest to went in more or less often – that tells you virtually nothing. I would say nothing. It's not quite right, but it's closer to right than wrong to say it tells you nothing about that player's defensive ability.
I'm much more interested in the number of shots that he's contested total, right? Like, I'm much more.
Even that tells me about as much as a player thing.
It tells me about activity, right? Like, that's what I can get from it. I can at least know, okay, this team does, hey, they run out to the three-point line. This team.
Why is he having to run out to the three-point line?
Well, you know why.
Yeah. Because Bojan Bogdanović got blown by on this. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. They don't have any defenders. You guys got anything else? Should we wrap up? It's been a long show.
I think we're good.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah, Mo just hits the yawn.
I think we've done good work here today. Yawn button. You want to tease next week?
Yeah. Guys, we're going to do a live trade deadline show, 2:30 Eastern on the Athletics YouTube channel. So go and subscribe to that channel if you haven't already. What you got, Mo?
We need the NBA guys to start making trades for this trade show to work. Okay. You guys got to help us out now. Okay. I know we spend some time on these shows shitting on y'all, but we need you to make trades, even bad ones. We just need the content, guys. Go to work. Especially bad ones. Go front office.
That's great radio.
Go to work. All of you need to get to work for us. Go.
We're going to get some kind of a weird trade. We'll have something. But anyway, we will be live on YouTube, the Athletics YouTube channel, 2:30 Eastern next Thursday for the trade deadline. I think we're going to go like an hour, hour and a half. We'll see. If there's a lot of trades, we'll obviously go longer. But it'll be us. We got Andrew Schlecht joining us, and we're going to have some special guests throughout the hour. So definitely check that out. Go and subscribe to the Athletics YouTube channel now. For Seth and Mo, I'm Dave. This has been Nerder, She Wrote, on the Athletic NBA Show.